Okay, my guest on Podcasting Softly this week is none other than Andrew David Barker. He is a writer, director, novelist, an actor as well. I know you did a small part somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
And very, very talented, man. Stop it. Stop it, Andrew. You're just too talented. It's very good to have you on Podcasting Softly.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah.
Hello.
So all the way from Warwick to Warwickshire, from Warwick, Queensland.
Yeah, that's a little strange coincidence, isn't it?
It is, yeah. From Warwick, Queensland to Warwickshire in the motherland, as we say here. From here in the colonies back to the motherland.
Yeah, it's raining, of course.
It's raining. Oh, well, it wouldn't be jolly old England if it wasn't raining, would it?
That's right.
So, Andrew, thank you for being on the show. You're a very, like I said at the top of the show, very talented man. You've got a lot of fingers in a lot of pies. So I guess, as I often begin these interviews, there's obviously people that know you, but there's probably a lot of people that don't. So for the people that don't know you, we'll universalize this whole thing, and if you could give us a little bit of, you know, a little bit of a history lesson as to the life and times of Andrew Barker before you became the Andrew Barker that we know and love.
Okay, well, it's a bit of a wayward journey. Yes, I directed this, I shot it in 2009. It took a couple of years to finish. I'd been wanting to make a feature film for a number of years, and it took a while to get things together. I'd sort of moved around doing different things. I'd shot a couple of short films. I was in a few bands. I was writing short stories. Creatively, I was kind of all over the map. I'm kind of still, but yeah, it took us a long time to sort of focus and hone in on, I suppose, getting serious about things. So, yeah, I directed that film, and I've written two novels so far, The Electric and Dead Leaves, and always trying to push something new onto the unsuspecting world.
So it was, you know, obviously you were trying to make films, so film was it a childhood passion, a childhood pursuit?
Yeah, I've always loved movies from a very young age. I was kind of obsessed. I think the first film I saw at the cinema was The Jungle Book, according to my mum. I do kind of vaguely remember it, or at least I think I do. Not the original release, of course, I'm not that old,
right.
But a re-release in the late 70s. And yeah, I was born in 1975, so I'm definitely of the Spielberg and Lucas generation, and that's really captured my imagination when I was a kid, those films. I always loved horror movies. I found horror movies by way of the old Universal Monster movies, which I loved as a kid and still love. And it's been a lifelong passion, really. I've always been a film fan, and then later, my mate at school got a video camera. This would have been about 1989, and we just started making films on Saturdays with his little sort of handy cam, and we'd sort of remake the movies of the day in his backyard. So we'd make Predator in a backyard in Derby, and Back to the Future, and, you know, Teen Wolf, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And all the stuff that we were watching and loving at the time. And that sort of feeling of being with a group of people and making something, even though we were just messing about, that initial feeling, that's never gone away, and I'm always trying to chase that and trying to relive that, I think.
Right. So with A Reckoning, it feels like, I said, I was very surprised. So because it's a film I'm not familiar with, and I subsequently have checked it out. And what I came away with, I mean, watching it now, obviously, had I watched it then, I wouldn't have made these comparisons. But watching it now, it sort of has kind of a Cormac McCarthy's The Road meet, you know, those Omega Man, you know, The Last Man on Earth, those types of films. Were they an influence?
Yeah, I've always loved post-apocalyptic films. I was a huge Mad Max fan when I was a kid. And I love I Am Legend, and, you know, Last Man on Earth. And there's just something about that landscape, the world in ruins. It's a very visceral and palpable landscape to play with. And yeah, the Cormac McCarthy book was an influence as well. I kind of wanted to make a post-apocalyptic film that was about the human condition, about what it means to be that in an empty world.
Right.
And what I came, you know, exploring the kind of day-to-day trivialities of life.
Right.
You know, how you'd hold on to things by giving your life a kind of mundane structure. But of course, it's all a fallacy, so it comes crashing down around my lone man's head and psyche.
It's also not a bad way to make an independent film where you've got a cast of very few people. As far as locations, you can find areas that are not as densely populated and obvious places that have been passed over by society's ever-growing nature. So, I mean, it's a very sensible, like, when it was the same with me when I was making short films, film school and all that sort of thing. I was, of course, drawn to the idea of a lone character type story.
Absolutely. I mean, we work to our limitations. I mean, I found the location first, which was an old RAF base just outside of Nottingham, and I just drove past it and then just pulled up and just kind of broke in. And it was just this whole village just left to rack and ruin. And I just thought, wow, this is a film set. I can make something here. Never thinking that I'd be able to get permission to go there. But already my mind was whirling with the possibilities. And, you know, the location obviously lent itself to that kind of film. And I just worked to my limitations. So I wrote around that location. I knew I wouldn't have much money, so, you know, it made sense just to have kind of one person in it, and it sort of evolved that way.
And was it the first screenplay you wrote, or did you write other screenplays prior to it?
No, I've written a few screenplays before that, all unmade, of course. But I was writing screenplays very early on. When I really started to take my writing seriously, I was in a band in the late 90s, and we got signed and made a single and thought we were famous, and obviously subsequently imploded.
Yeah.
And then when the dust settled, I thought, you know, because I'd always written during the 90s, but I thought, well, I'm going to really try and take this seriously, and screenplays were what I gravitated towards first. The novel stuff came later. I mean, I used to write short stories as well. But, so yeah, I've got quite a few scripts in this drawer here, bottom drawer.
Right. Yes, we all we've all got that
bottom drawer,
that infamous bottom drawer with all the greatest films that have never been made.
Absolutely. Yeah.
People say to me, "Oh, what's the greatest film ever made?" And I said, "Well, I can't tell you." And they say, "Why?" I said, "Because I haven't made it."
That's a good. I'm going to remember that. I'm going to use that one.
Because it hasn't been made. It's in the drawer at home. So once it gets made, I'll let you know. And then you'll see it. You can quite very happily sit down and see the greatest. But, you know, it's always the sort of when you're just as solely a writer, which you have been as well, and are as well, in contrast with being a filmmaker, finding one's style, voice, whatever you want to call it, seems to be that is the task of the formative years when you're trying to make that first film or short films or write that first
Absolutely.
Or that first novel or that. So, I mean,
it takes a while to find your way. It really does. Yeah, it took me a long time, a fair few years.
Yeah,
and I'm still doing it. You know, it's never going to stop. I'm still trying to find my way with it all and try and get to that place where I'm writing something that is purely me, that is honest and true to who I am.
Right. Stop me if I'm wrong, but I mean, I started writing books as well. One of my primary motivations, though, is because I couldn't sell the scripts, so I started to turn the scripts into books. Was that part of the motivation, or did you just want, you knew you could write a novel and wanted to, or you just had an idea for a film and thought, well, there's no way I can possibly make the film, so I'll write the book? Was that?
No, I'd always wanted to write a novel. Me and my mate started a novel when we were 16. Writing together, and it was terrible, obviously, but we thought it was brilliant. But that was really good fun. We worked on it for years, like off and on. You know, we thought it was going to be our magnum opus, but it was ridiculous. It was.
What's the good pictures that you've seen recently? Have you seen Blade Runner?
I have. You know, I've got a 3-year-old, so I never get to the cinema anymore.
Oh, okay.
Um, No, I haven't seen Blade Runner. I've been watching a lot of stuff. I have to watch a lot of stuff at home now. So I'm probably 6 months behind everything.
Right.
So I have to wait till it comes on some streaming service before before I can catch up. At the minute, I've been watching a lot of really low-budget independent films,
right,
just for kind of inspiration. I've been watching a lot of Joe Swanberg and the Duplass brothers and that kind of stuff, because they're inspiring me, because they're just showing me that it is doable, you know, that because I'm thinking of stepping back in and making some more stuff, and I want to ease back in by making it as simple as possible for myself. So, you know, a couple of people talking in a room is where I'm at the minute.
Right. Well, I mean, the technology's there. I mean, if they're making films with iPhones and all that sort of stuff now, so...
Absolutely.
It's wide open.
It is wide open, absolutely.
But like they say, it doesn't really matter how you commit the stuff to the visual medium, as long as the story is a good story.
Yeah. I found, because I used to, as you could probably tell by the film that I made, but I used to really shy away from writing dialogue.
Right.
But I love it now. And I think that's come through the novels that I wrote, particularly the second novel, Dead Leaves, which is, that one's about kids in the early 80s during the sort of video nasty media for war that we had over here during that time, and a group of horror film fans trying to track down a copy of The Evil Dead.
Right.
And that one is just, it's all character, it's all dialogue, it's all these kids just talking like the way me and my mates used to talk to each other, which I just don't find in literature or film.
No.
You know, the certain way of the way that we used to, you know, just rib each other and take the piss. And I found I really enjoyed writing the dialogue there, and it sort of led me down perhaps not a different path, but it's led me down to writing more character-based stuff, just so I can get my teeth into dialogue.
Yeah.
That's my thing at the minute.
Well, it's fun when you've got good characters like in Dead Leaves, and you're trying to capture the era of a certain generation or a certain time in your own life, because I don't know about you, but I don't think I've ever seen a movie where I've heard people talk the way I think people talk. It's either very it's either very lofty, or there's lots of people talking monologues, you know yourself, you and your friends don't give speeches.
Yeah, you're always cutting each other up, and absolutely.
And it's very monosyllabic, like, oh yeah, right, good, stuff like that, you
know? My novel's full of that.
Yeah.
and very bad language, my mother told me.
All right, yeah.
She wasn't very pleased with that one.
Yeah, I've been down that street. I wrote a script with a friend some time back, and I mean, he's very proper. I like the four letter curses.
Absolutely.
I've got
no problem with swearing. It is big and it is clever.
Yeah, I don't think they've invented a better, certainly more versatile words yet. Once they do, I'll use them. But yeah, but anyway, so I added, as is my want to add them. And so his mother picked it up off the table one night because he left it there, and apparently she turned purple. She was a bit prudish and had a small fit of some kind, and
it got a reaction.
You talked about the films that you grew up with, the, you know, the camera and the years of Spielberg and Lucas and all those types of movies, but what were the films and the filmmakers that, I don't know, they of course those early ones have a lasting impression, but after those, what were the films and the filmmakers that that have stayed with you and continue to influence me?
I'm a big horror film fan, so the horror films of the 70s and 80s and those big sort of horror directors it's me. John Carpenter is still a huge pull. He still gets me, just thinking about his films gets me excited and wants me to go and do something, just make something. Early on, I loved George Romero. I love people and I love The Evil Dead because I love the idea of the, you know, just kids going out and making this movie.
Yeah.
And I find that incredibly inspiring. I mean, with Dead Leaves, I've written an entire novel about it, really.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, just, I mean, Sam Raimi was like 18 when he started that film or something ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't even write my name at 18. So I find that really inspiring.
Yeah.
And still do, you know, people just creating their own opportunity.
Totally.
And, you know, I love I kind of watch far and wide, really. I love westerns. I love a lot of genre films. I love Martin Scorsese. But the films that I come back to, the ones that make me want to do something, are normally the sort of lower budget films. The ones that I feel they've had to do this themselves. The ones that really got their hands dirty. They're the ones I always go back to.
Right. And are you a fan of? Obviously the. The first Evil Dead movie, or do you like the whole series?
Yeah, I like them all. I like them all for different reasons. But the first one, I think, is the story behind it that really appeals to
right,
me.
Right. Yeah.
I get the sense of that when I watch it. That you know they really are just out there on their own doing it themselves.
The whole sort of daring do of just going out there and making a film.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, ironically,
and it's such an inventive film.
Totally. I mean, it's ironic that you say that and mention Sam Raimi, because I think Sam Raimi was the first Hollywood director that I'd ever heard say this. It was actually on a commentary track. I think it's on the commentary track for Spider-Man 2. And I'd never heard anyone say it, but it is true, and it's true of all levels of filmmaking and art, really, in general. He says to Tobey Maguire at one point, he says, well, we went out and made a film because this business is a catch-22 business. They weren't going to let me make films until I'd actually made it.
Wow.
Right? So I'd never heard a sort of a big-timer say that, but that was always, like, I thought, something that lingered under the surface.
Absolutely.
I remember...
It's like I said, they created their own opportunity. They forged their own careers out of that.
Totally.
It's amazing.
Totally, because I remember going to try and get funding early on out of film school because I didn't have enough money to even go out and attempt to make a movie because I didn't have any gear or anything like that and knew no one that had any gear or anything like that. And went to them and literally, I heard it back then. They said, well, you know, what's the back end like on this? And I said, well, the back end, I said, it's a short film. I mean, aside from the fact that, you know, I mean, what do you want me to do? Walk around the audiences at the festivals with a hat saying, you know, if you like this, throw a couple of cents in or something, and I'll come back and give you a cut of it. I said, are you mad? What's the back end like? I said, here, I'll bend over and I'll show you what the back end looks like. right?
So, I take it you got the money then?
No, they said, look, this is a catch-22 business. We're not going to give you the money to make a film until you've actually made one.
And I thought, it's crazy, yeah. I mean, short films are a calling card.
Yeah.
I don't know how anyone can make any money out of a short film, particularly now. In fact, the whole thing's in flux now. I don't really know where it's going to land because I don't know how independent films do make money now, unless you're picked up by a streaming service.
Yeah.
I mean, no one's buying DVDs now. There's no distribution in that, really.
No.
In 5 years, they'll be totally gone, probably.
Yeah.
So, the film that I made on that level, where would that go? This is the sort of naivety that I had when I made my film, and it was even different. It was different then to what it is now. There were still DVDs then, or at least people were still buying them. It's all in flux. You could play a festival with that, and then what? Where does it go?
Yeah.
If you're not picked up by, you know, a streaming service,
exactly.
Where are these films being shown?
Yeah.
And how are these films going to be seen?
Mm.
It's interesting. I mean, I think Amazon have opened their doors to allow people to upload their own movies on their streaming service.
Yes.
Which is interesting.
Mm.
Obviously, it means there'll be a glut of absolute garbage on there, but there'll be some gems, you know.
Oh, certainly.
But it's finding them.
Mm.
You're kind of a needle in a haystack now.
Yeah.
So you've got to be good at getting out there and marketing yourself, because how else are you going to be found?
That's true.
It's weird. I don't know where it's all going. Yeah.
Well, the best analogy I heard, with regard to that type of quest, was Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez were at a festival. I can't remember which one. But he was asked from the audience. He said, "This filmmaker said, how do I get up there? How do I get to where you are?" And he said, well, and this was, I thought, a very good analogy of not only filmmaking, but trying to get yourself out there in whatever medium it is you choose to do it.
Yeah.
And that was, he said, we're all like the waves of the sea, right? The waves keep coming in, right? And they crash against the shore and they go out and they come back in, right? And every wave's the same. It's a wave, right? Okay, it's water and it's got salt and it comes back and it goes out. And he said, you have to be the wave with a killer shark on it, okay? And the dude looked at him and goes, you have to put a killer shark on your wave, right? To be noticed, okay?
Yeah.
And he said, my killer shark was Reservoir Dogs. And he said, I made this film, and because of budgetary constraints, just like you were talking about before, I did with what I had, and he said, we can't afford to shoot the bank robbery. So he said, okay, fine. What if we never show the bank robbery? Okay? We show everything around the bank robbery. Right? And so we're all hearing about this big bank robbery that happens, and there's certain characters that get killed. We don't see them get killed. All we know is that they got killed. And then the end, it comes down to this, you know, it comes down just like in John Carpenter's The Thing. You know, a lot of people say, you know, it's a science fiction picture, it's an alien picture, it's a horror picture. As Kurt Russell once said, it's just a bit movie about 10 guys in paranoia, right?
Yeah.
and they're trapped in this, not only in a confined space, but a very, very confined environment. They're essentially stuck in the middle of nowhere in the most abysmal conditions. So they're, even if they leave, where are they going to go? Well, they're not going to leave. They're going to go, right?
Yeah,
they're not going to walk out of there, right? So it's very true. He says, you know, you need to put a killer shark on your way. You really need to...
I saw that interview with Quentin, and he was absolutely right. I mean...
Yeah.
You know, he basically said, you've got to make Reservoir Dogs. And, you know, that's, of course, that's easier said than done. I mean, he captured lightning in the bottle there.
Yeah.
But he's absolutely right. I've also heard Toby Hooper talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm. And he said that what he wanted to do was send a flare up from Texas that would be seen by Hollywood.
Right.
And I thought that was great.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what he did.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, that's what you've got to do. You've got to send a flare up.
Yeah.
You've got to bring a killer shark in on your way.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, you just get lost in the noise. I'm still trying to do it.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult thing to do.
It is.
But,
And it's weird too, and sorry to cut you off, but it's weird too because I was listening to a, on YouTube, I was listening to a screenwriting guru, I forget his name, last night on YouTube. I was just stuffing around, I was listening to this bloke. And he said, you know, young screenwriters today, the biggest mistake that they make is trying to be clever. They're trying to swap being ingenious for story. Now, that's fine. In some respect, that's fine. Yes, you do have to be very conscious of your story and have a story and have a good through line and all that sort of thing. But I think it's wrong to sort of say you have to try not look for something that's clever, because you do. You do have to look inside yourself to something like, hey, that's a really clever idea. I haven't seen a film like that.
Yeah.
Because just like you're saying, we're all trying to find a foothold so we don't slide off the mountain. And I think you do have to be, you do have to have both. You have to have a good idea of what your story is and what your through line is. But you also need to think of trying to come up with something you think, well, hey, that's catchy. You know, it's almost like you come up with a tune in your head going, I've never heard a tune like that. And that really sticks. I wonder if other people will think it sticks as well, you know.
Absolutely.
So,
you've got to try and find your thing as well. And I've been exploring through my own work my thing, my identity. And I think that comes from writing about kids. I've written two novels about kids, older kids, teenagers, you know, and the way they speak to each other, the language that they use. I think that's my thing. But also, like with The Electric, I tried to find a premise that was really cool.
Yeah.
You know? I tried to. You know, it's about a cinema that shows movies made by ghosts.
Yeah.
So you've got these 80s kids who stumble over this cinema and they're showing movies by, you know, the way you've got a movie star in Harold Lloyd and John Belushi.
Totally.
You know, because I can mix up all these stars, and I got to create all these movies within that premise, and that was a whole lot of fun. Got to use up a lot of my movie ideas in that book.
Totally.
So you know that's really coming from me because I love movies. The kids in the 80s, which I understand, I was a kid in the 80s, and you know, I just tried to write the truest book that I could, that comes from everything that I love and everything that I am.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you got to do. You know, but at the same time, you've got to tell a great story.
Oh, absolutely. And yes, it is a wonderful premise. I mean, for me, what I got out of it was very much, I thought, when I was reading, I was thinking like it's Matinee meets The Purple Eyes of Coro meets Monster Squad. You know, it was very...
That's great. That's cool.
You know, so, I mean, if you were going to, you know, I mean, there's your one sentence pitch when you go to the studio right there. You say it's Matinee meets Purple Rose of Cairo meets Monster Squad.
I like that a lot. Yeah,
so,
I like that.
You know, that's certainly when I was reading, that's what I got, because I think those films, certainly Purple Rose of Cairo, I thought was a great premise when I first saw it. I thought the idea of film, I mean, in your film, the characters of the films are also making films, but the idea of characters stepping out of a movie, and it was done again, not as well, Last Action Hero, which I thought was a really lost opportunity. I thought they could have been so good. That was, I love that film for what it's not, which is odd to say, but I love
it's,
that.
It's good fun. I like that film.
I love that film for what it's not. More so for what it could have been. I thought, yeah, that's a great. It's almost like the action film. It could have been the action film version of Purple Rose of Cairo. But you know, there was a lot of, you know. I mean, there's a great book called Fiasco, which has a great write up about all of the ridiculousness that went on behind the scenes with Last Action Hero, if you ever want to check
it out. Oh, really? What's that called?
It's called, I've got it here.
Fiasco.
It's called Fiasco, A History of Hollywood's Iconic Flops.
That sounds great.
Written by James Robert Parrish.
Right, I'm going to buy that today. I love stuff like that. I love reading about the underdog.
And it's got a wonderful sort of lineup of the. It's got some of the big ones. I was surprised that some of the ones that were included. Some of them I knew that would be in there. Obviously, there's Cleopatra.
Race the Titanic.
No, that's not in there. Right? It's got Cleopatra. It's got Paint Your Wagon. Waterworld.
Paint Your Wagon.
Yeah. Paint Your Wagon.
Okay.
Popeye.
Yeah.
Showgirls, obviously. Last Action Hero. Battlefield Earth. Ishtar.
Yeah.
Shanghai Surprise. The Cotton
Club. Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So you'll enjoy that.
I will enjoy that. Yeah. I'm going to
get that today. See, there you go. But so that's got some great write-ups of all of the ridiculousness that went on, or should I say the excess behind the scenes.
Which, I mean, having made a film, I can see how easy it is to go wrong.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many elements. So many things to deal with. And you know, we made a film with a crew of 15 people.
Right.
You know, very, very, very small. If you've got hundreds of people, and you're juggling so many plates, it's a miracle anything good comes out of it. You've got to really, really know what. I mean, these guys that do it again and again, these people, these filmmakers, these men and women are seriously talented people to have careers of longevity, you know, to do it again and again. You've really got to know what you're doing.
Totally.
But at the same time, nobody knows what they're doing, because it's all instinct.
Yeah.
It's all, you know, there's so many right or wrong ways to shoot a scene.
Yeah.
Any given scene.
Totally.
And you've just got to go on your gut instinct about which is the best way. And sometimes, how can you always know?
Yeah. Totally.
it's filmmaking is it's a really, I mean, that's why it's so different. So different to writing novels. You know, there's a real control in writing a novel. It's just you. There's no budgetary constraints. You know, you can do anything. You can go anywhere, and you've only got you to rely on.
Certainly.
And no elements to battle, which is, you know, part of the appeal of writing novels. Certainly. But also at the same time, all of that that causes the chaos is part of the fun of making a film as well. You know, it's you are trying to capture something, you know, and it's not, you know, you've got to be flexible. You've got to be able to bend and shoot on the fly, because you can plan and plan to the absolute detail, but there on the day, on the set, on that moment, anything can happen.
Yeah.
And that's part of the fun. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. As to quote Geoffrey Rush from Shakespeare in Love, when they say, you know, it works out well, he says, how do you know that? He says, I don't know, it's a mystery.
Yeah.
Which it is. It is the greatest mystery, how all of these elements on all of these films, both that, you know, that you've experienced by making yourself, or certainly all the films that you've seen, and the films that we herald today as the greatest films of all time, and the ones we see recently say, hey, that was a good movie. How all of those elements come together to combine what you would say at the breakfast table, saying, oh, that was a great movie I saw last night. If you could honestly say how it all worked to make it a good film, you'd probably be running a major studio by now. But
absolutely.
Yeah, but yeah. Most often than not, people say, how does it all work? You say, I don't know. It's a mystery.
Yeah. I mean, look at Jaws. I mean, Jaws is one of my favourite movies.
Totally.
And everyone knows the struggle they had to make that film.
Totally.
I mean, by rights, how that film was made, it should have been a disaster.
Yeah.
With the talent there, the drive of Spielberg somehow made it what it is, which I believe is a masterpiece.
Totally. But you can't obviously see, I mean...
But he didn't know.
No,
you know,
no, totally.
He was just trying to make the best of that situation
at the time. And if we saw it again, I sometimes you wonder, in some mysterious universe perhaps, if these films had turned out and gone smoothly the way they were meant to have gone, on time and on budget, and you could see it in this alternative universe, the way it should have gone with all the elements working correctly, and play them both side by side, which would be the better film. It would be interesting, wouldn't it?
It would be very interesting, yeah. I mean, with Jaws is probably a very different film because of the nature of, you know, the fact that they couldn't shoot the shark, so they had to, you know, they started workshopping loads of scenes for the actors to just bounce off each other and have lots of dialogue scenes where I think the original script, they had a lot more of the shark.
Yeah, and I think it's ironic, too, that the fact...
They captured magic.
Yeah, and I think it's ironic, too, that the fact that after that, what was completely an accident in Jaws then became sort of a precedent. Like, I don't show the monster too early.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if you give the game away too early, then you'll have nowhere else to go. And, of course, I think the shark turns up in full force at exactly the right time in that film. You know, obviously, we get lots of little hints of what this animal is like, but when he finally comes out and we find out that we do definitely need a bigger boat, it comes at exactly the right time.
Absolutely, yeah. Wow.
But of course,
I watch it every year.
I know, it's a wonderful, wonderful film. Andrew, you've been very generous with your time. I thank you very much for being on the show. Andrew's film, A Reckoning, is a wonderful movie, a post-apocalyptic drama. I hope, if you haven't seen it out there, I hope you certainly get a chance to watch it. It was a little revelation for me, because I admit I had not seen it, and was able to finally see it. Both of his books, I admit I've only read one of them, The Electric and Dead Leaves. The Electric's a great, great book. I will certainly be also checking out Dead Leaves when I get a chance. Both have been optioned. Is that true, Andrew?
Yeah, The Electric has been optioned. There was a producer interested in Dead Leaves, but that's kind of gone quiet at the minute. But
okay.
I'm hoping to pick that back up again. But thank you. Thank you for all that. That's wonderful to hear.
Yeah.
That's really good. I mean, you do things sometimes, you know, in isolation, and you don't know how they're going to be perceived, and it's wonderful to hear when people have a reaction, you know, and enjoy the stuff.
Yeah, well, they're wonderful books. I hope you continue with that. I hope you get back into movies, because I like what you began. I hope you get a chance to come back around, and we'll have another Andrew Barker film.
Thank you, man. I'm trying. I'm yeah. working on hopefully stepping back in the game next year.
Yeah, that'll be great.
Brilliant. Yeah. No, I've really enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
Totally. It's been absolutely fun.